Welcome to ID the Future, the podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm your host, Ray Bolin. And today I'm talking with Dr. Howard Glicksman, the physician who wrote an excellent 81-part series for the Discovery Institute's Evolution News blog. The name of the series is The Designed Body, that was posted on ENV website from February 2015 to September 2016. So welcome, Howard.
Thank you very much, Ray. It's great to be here.
Well, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your work and how this discussion came about?
Well, Ray, I've been a general practitioner, a physician for almost 40 years, you know, the first 25 of which I had an office and hospital practice. And then after that, I've been a hospice and palliative care physician. And now more concentrating on complex medical cases involving, you know, the heart, the lung, kidney, and the liver. So, you know, you really think about it, what I do every day is like practical biology. And over the years, I had to come up with ways to explain in simple terms to my patients how the body works. Of course, being the way I am, type of guy I am, right after I finish explaining to the patient, you know, how the heart works or how the sugar gets controlled, you know, I come up with this line and say, hey, you know, you realize, of course, that everything I just explained to you came about by chemicals just randomly coming together from the laws of nature. And, you know, there was no intelligence directing this, you know. And usually the patient and the family sort of give me this quizzical look, and someone would say, oh, come on, doc, you don't believe that stuff, do you? You know. And I'd say, well, no, I don't, but if you really think about it, that's what our kids are being taught in school. So, you know, a few years later, I was introduced to intelligent design, and I started reading books by William Dembski and of course, Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe. And then one day I was talking to someone about how Darwinism is taught in the schools. And he happened to mention to me that his aunt was a physical anthropologist who digs up human bones and gives them to museums. And it was that very night I woke up with this thought. And that was that I realized that museums of natural history display human skeletons, place them next to ones of other primates and animals, you know, to try to validate Darwinism, right? But they do this without explaining how bones work, like the fact that there's two different types of cells in the bone. You know, there's the bone-forming cells called the osteoblasts, which deposit calcium in the bone. And there's the bone-breakdown cells called the osteoclasts, which release calcium from the bone. And also they don't mention that 99% of the calcium in the body is in your bones, but the remaining is just as important. The remaining 1% is in the organelles and fluid within your cells or in the fluid outside the cells. So this was all very important, and then I realized that the bones are the reservoir for the calcium needs of the body. Now, they're vital for nerve, gland, and muscle function, and calcium has to be controlled like many other chemicals in the body, like oxygen, water, and sugar. So, you know, I said to myself, we need to educate people, especially students, about this, you know, because how can you understand where life came from if you don't understand how it actually works? And so with my writings, I hope people, and especially students, will start to ask questions that will help raise the bar for Darwinists.
Well, you mentioned a very important word, and that was control. So you mentioned that the calcium is stored in our bones. That's where 99% of it is. But then there's also a function for calcium in other types of cells, a very specific function. So there is a small amount of calcium outside of our bones. So what I'm wondering is there a connection between the calcium in our bones and the calcium needs of, say, nerve, gland, and muscle cells, as you mentioned?
Yes, I think to understand how this all works, you first need to sort of understand how the body is set up. And so, and this requires understanding where water is. You know, the water in your body is either inside your cells or outside your cells. And if it's outside your cells, it's either in your blood or between your cells. So you may know that the blood travels through the arterial system to the capillary. So, you know, the blood comes from the heart and it's carrying everything the cells and the tissues need. It's got the oxygen, it's got the sugar, it's got fats, it's got proteins, it's got water, sodium, etc. And it comes into the capillaries, and this is where the exchange of chemicals takes place between the circulation and the cells. However, it doesn't go straight from the circulation into the cell. It goes into the fluid around the cell, and so this fluid around the cell between the cells, as I said, it acts as a bridge between the bloodstream and the cell. Okay, so similarly, you have cells in the bone, and you have fluid around that bone, okay? And that is in direct contact with the capillaries or the blood supply. So this is how the bone can act as a reservoir for the calcium needs of the body, because the bone, through the bone fluid around it, is in direct contact with the capillaries and the blood in the circulation. So it turns out that the concentration of calcium in the fluid outside the cells is 10,000 times more than it is inside the cell. And when nerve, gland, and muscle cells are properly stimulated, this opens up something called calcium ion channels in the cell membrane. And you know how you hear in the weather report that, you know, there's a high pressure system all over South Dakota and the air is moving to a low pressure system in Missouri, okay? So we know that air moves from a high pressure system to a low pressure system. Well, the same thing happens in the body. If there's fluid that has a high concentration of a chemical like calcium, and these channels open up in the cell membrane to allow it to move into the cell, then it's naturally going to flood into the cell because the concentration outside the cell is 10,000 times more than inside. And this is called calcium signaling. When this calcium floods into the cell, this is what makes the neuron release its neurotransmitter, the gland cell release its hormone, and the muscle cell contract. And of course, without this setup, none of these cells could function. And of course, there would be death.
Oh, well, death, that's a pretty hard stop. Let me get back to that in just a minute. But you said some pretty amazing things here, that the calcium concentration in the fluid outside the cells is 10,000 times more than what it is inside the cell. Now, if anybody understands diffusion at all, then what's going to happen is that you would think, at least, that that large amount of calcium outside the cell is just going to flood into the cell. It's kind of like holding a bowling ball up at the top of a very steep ramp, and there's got to be something there to keep that bowling ball from just running down the ramp. And so how is that calcium level outside the cell maintained? Why doesn't it just rush right into the cell?
Well, I'm not a molecular biologist, but my understanding is that the cell membrane does not allow the calcium to go through. It needs help to get through the cell membrane.
Oh.
Through these ion channels. And of course, that's how the control occurs for the nerve, gland, and muscle cells, that at the right time, when they get stimulated properly, then these channels open up. And then that allows the fluid from outside to go inside. And so it's a control.
Okay, so these channels are sort of like gates then. And the gate is either open or it's closed. If the gate is closed, then the calcium has no way of getting into the cell. When the gates are open, then that flow is able to take place. But let me go back to this issue of death. You said if this system isn't working, then that results in death. And that's a really, really hard stop, a really major consequence. So this does lead to a few more questions. Now, this huge concentration difference, how does that happen? How does that work?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. It's a logical question from what we've just discussed. And it just so happens that these cells have something called calcium pumps in the cell membrane. So just imagine this. You have the nerve cell, the gland cell, and the muscle cell. They've just done their job. Okay, they've done what they had to do. The calcium's flooded in there. But now they realize, hey, for us to be able to do this again, we got to get rid of this calcium. There's too much in here. We got to set up that relationship again so that we have a low concentration of calcium inside and to get it back outside. So the cell membrane has these calcium pumps that require energy to pump that calcium back out. And that's what they do in preparation to function again.
Okay. So the pump is different from the ion channel. The pump actually moves things against the concentration gradient, takes things from a less concentrated area, pumps them out to a more concentrated area. And the ion channel is just, like I said earlier, a gate that's either open or closed. So again, that sounds like a pretty integrated system. And you're talking about a really very complex and very coordinated system. So when Darwinists talk about this, where do they go with it? How do they try to explain how this kind of system came into being?
Well, they don't really get into specifics. What I notice is that they do talk about calcium signaling and that it's dependent on, you know, the calcium ion channels and having the calcium pumps. Of course, they never mention that you have to have both of them there at the same time for it to function. So, if you look it up, they talk about the molecular structure of them and how they function. It's pretty high-powered stuff. But they only talk about it at a cellular level, okay? Because the thing that they leave out in that discussion, right, which is what I noticed, is they also leave out the need to control the calcium concentration outside the cell, okay? I mean, it's important for it to be low inside, but it's got to be high. It's got to be 10,000 times high outside the cell. You got to remember that these cells in the nerves and glands and the muscles, they're programmed to pump out calcium. They have no knowledge of what else is going on in the body. Okay, this is at the cellular level. We have a multicellular body, all right? It's got to somehow be able to control that calcium in what's called the extracellular fluid or the fluid outside the cell. and keep it at 10,000 times more of that. And frankly, we know by clinical experience that if it's 5,000 or 15,000, you're dead. So it has to be about 10,000 times. So here's the question that struck me when I started writing about this. You know, remember we just said that the bone is in direct contact with the circulation, right? You got the bone cells, you got the fluid around the bone cells, and that's where the bone cells get their calcium from. They take the calcium, they put it back and forth, they deposit bone, they release it. And then that bone fluid is in direct contact with the circulation. So here's the question. What's to stop all the bones in the body from taking all that calcium and depositing it as solid bone? Okay. In other words, what if the bones contain not just 99% of the calcium, but 99.99%? All right. Instead, that would effectively remove almost all the calcium out of solution in the fluid outside the cells. Okay. And you would have no nerve, gland, or muscle function. And you, once again, I know you don't like it, but you'd have death.
There's that death problem again.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, so how is the calcium balance maintained? How does the body maintain only 99% of calcium in the bones and not 99.99%? How does that take place?
Well, before we get into the specifics of this, we need to talk about how does the body control anything. In fact, how does anybody control anything? You had Steve Loffman on here in the past, and he's an engineer, and I think he talked about five components. But I'm just a physician. In fact, I'm just a GP. So I bring it down to three, okay?
Okay.
The first is that you need a sensor. You need to have something that can detect what needs to be controlled, okay?
Okay.
And the second thing you need is an integrator, something that takes that information from the sensor, compares it with a standard, decides if something has to be done, and if so, sends out orders. And in the body, that's usually done by sending out hormones from the glands or sending out neurohormones or neurotransmitters from the nerve cells. And then, none of this is useful unless it actually accomplishes something. And so there's something called the effectors, something that effects a change. And
okay.
So these hormones or neurohormones or these messages will go out to what's called target cells, and they'll tell them to do something. And usually what they're telling them to do is going to affect the thing you're trying to control. So when we get into specifically about calcium, this is how it works. Everyone's familiar with the large gland called the thyroid gland. It's sort of shaped like an H in the middle of your neck. But at the end of each arm is a small parathyroid gland. So there's four of them because you have four arms to the letter H.
Yeah.
Okay? And the parathyroid glands, we'll just start by saying, they send out a certain amount of appropriately named parathyroid hormone. Its short form is PTH, just a little easier to say. Okay? So you got PTH coming out of these parathyroid glands. Okay. Now, the gland cells have calcium sensors in the cell membrane. All right? And these calcium sensors monitor the calcium level in the blood. And the gland cell then integrates this information, and if it goes down too much, you know, within a minute or two, it sends out more PTH. And if it goes up too much, it sends out less PTH. So we've got the sensor, and we've got the integration. Now the question becomes, okay, what does it do, all right?
Right.
So the PTH now travels in the blood, and it attaches to specific PTH receptors like a key in a lock in the effector cells located in the bone and kidneys. Now, this type of issue with respect to the hormone and the receptor, my understanding basically is that, you know, every protein is made up of a certain sequence of amino acids, and that sequence also determines its three-dimensionality, okay?
Right.
So the PTH, if I'm not mistaken, I think it starts off with 84 amino acids, and so it's got a certain shape, all right? And it's coming along, and it comes out into the bone and the kidney cells, and it comes up against the PTH receptor, which also, in the cell membrane, that has its own three-dimensionality. And somehow, somewhere within that, there's something where they can connect up, like, you know, Velcro or like a key in a lock. PTH attaches to the receptor, and when that happens, that signals the cell to do something, okay?
Okay.
So let's get to the specifics of what it does. In the bone, when PTH kicks into the bone cells, it basically tells it to release more calcium from the bone, which eventually goes into the bloodstream. In the kidneys, it goes to the kidney cells along the tubules. Now, you remember, kidneys, you know, filter the blood and they form urine. So this water is going through your kidneys, and the kidney will bring back, you know, 99% of the water, 99.5% of the sodium, about 90-95% of your potassium, pretty well all this glucose, most of the protein it should bring back, and it also brings back calcium, all right?
Oh, okay.
So the PTH goes in there and it tells those cells, you know what? I need more calcium. Bring more back, okay? And the third thing, which is just phenomenal, this is just a great thing. Okay, the third thing is the kidney cells also happen to activate vitamin D. So a lot of people, you know, you take vitamin D in your vitamins. Most people don't know that vitamin D has to be activated by the body. And so the vitamin D goes to your liver, and the liver puts a hydroxyl group, an oxygen and a hydrogen, on the 25th carbon of vitamin D. But it's not ready. It's not activated yet. Then it goes to the kidney, all right? And the kidney has two options. These kidney cells have two options. They can either put another hydroxyl, hydrogen and oxygen, on the 24th carbon, in which case vitamin D won't be very active, or not at all, or it can put it on the first carbon. And when it does that, it becomes calcitriol, which is activated vitamin D. Now, vitamin D not only works in the bone, but for our discussion, it goes to the intestinal cells in the GI system, and it tells them to bring in more calcium from the food you're eating. So if you look at all three of these actions, okay, the bone cells releasing more calcium in the bloodstream, the kidney cells bringing back more calcium from the urine in production, and the kidney cells activating vitamin D, sends it to the intestines bring in more calcium, they all work to raise the calcium level back to normal.
That's all extremely complex. It's just amazing, as you've already said, that, well, there's these sensors in the parathyroid gland, and I kind of look at those maybe like a thermometer. Thermometer sense temperature, and somehow the parathyroid gland is sensing how much calcium is in the blood. And then there's a, what you say, an integrator. I like to say maybe an interpreter that interprets that level of calcium. And then that actually kind of in interpreting that, it also then sends out a message to the effectors to say, you need to do your job. And there's, as you said, there's a very specific lock and key mechanism to the receptors, the effectors. And then that sends out a message that tells three different systems to either increase or decrease the amount of calcium. So you have the bones can release it or take it in. The kidneys can keep more back or let more out. And the intestines can also take in more calcium or not. And all of that is a very highly integrated system. And you said in your ENV posts that this calcium balance system is irreducibly complex by Behe's definition. So could you fill that out a little bit for us?
Well, yeah, I think just if you just summarize it, first of all, you have to have the calcium sensors placed exactly where they need to be on the parathyroid gland cells, which just happen to have the ability to produce a hormone, PTH, that affects calcium metabolism. And then they go out and attach to specific PTH receptors in the bone and the kidneys to tell them what to do when the calcium level isn't just right. Now, what you can see by the system, without any one part being present or doing the job correctly, the system fails.
Hmm. So, again, a failing sounds like another death problem. So,
yeah, sorry about that, Ray. I know you have a problem with that. We'll talk about that later. I'm a hospice doctor. So
let's just say that my blood calcium levels are lower than they need to be, and somehow the system doesn't react to increase the blood calcium levels, or perhaps even worse, the situation is misinterpreted and calcium levels fall even lower in my bloodstream. So what consequences do I face to that, at least immediately?
Right. Well, you know, the thing that's interesting about, talking about all these issues is that we have to look at these systems through the lens of dysfunction, okay? So what you're talking about can actually happen in real life, and it's sort of, you know, what you're talking about is like the sudden failure of parathyroid function. And this sometimes happens after thyroid surgery, because remember, the parathyroid glands are sort of embedded in the four limbs of the thyroid gland. So when someone has thyroid surgery, sometimes the parathyroid glands are accidentally removed or even damaged, okay? It's a major postoperative complication that can quickly result in death because the calcium level in the blood starts to plummet. And this causes muscle spasms, seizures, coma, and death. Now, of course, modern medicine now has ways of treating this condition, but that wouldn't have been helpful to our earliest ancestors, nor for the other organisms that need calcium control. So this goes to show that the absence of PTH and any of the parts that make up its irreducibly complex system of calcium control is incompatible with life. But it also shows that the system has to inherently know what the calcium level should be in the first place. I sort of wrote a whole series about this, and that's what's in the Design Body, but also in another website about what's called Beyond Irreducible Complexity, because that irreducible complexity isn't enough. It doesn't automatically make it capable of life, because what we've inherently said in here is that the parathyroid glands, they have a set point, like a thermostat, like you're saying, that has to know what the level should be in order to react. Now, where that information comes from is a good question, all right? And this, of course, applies to every other control system of the body. You know, and that at the end, I think the last in a series, in that series of 81 articles, I go through 40 different parameters, you know, glucose, water, blood pressure, sodium, potassium, pulse rate, respiratory, all these different things that need to be within a certain range. Otherwise, I'm sorry to say this, but it's death. It's the whole base of medical practice, you know?
This really is just incredibly sophisticated, and we touched on it earlier. But, Doc, how do Darwinists explain how all of this came about? Do they even offer any plausible idea of how this incredibly complex system could have originated by evolutionary process?
Well, you know, unless it's out there, I haven't been able to find it. I would say that they don't. But what they do, if you look up, you go on the Internet and you look up the evolution of parathyroid hormone or the evolution of the calcium sensor receptor or the PTH receptor, you'll see that, once again, just like with the calcium ion channel and the pump, they talk about everything in isolation, all right? So they'll talk about the PTH, and they'll compare its molecular structures to what's in other organisms, okay? So to me, you know, that's no different than looking at how evolution, you know, the evolution of various human inventions, you know, like cars, computers, and rockets. But they never in those articles talk about, you know, we realize that you have to have all three of these things in place at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So they just talk about it in isolation. So in effect, they just paper over it with it evolved over time. But as I said, any engineer or inventor will tell you that the devil's in the details, which with Darwinism are conspicuously absent. And I'd sort of like to add, if I can, Ray, just, you know, I started, mm-hmm. when we started talking, I said, you know, that I'm hoping that if people can understand how the body works, and, you know, maybe we'll get to do more of these because there's lots of stuff to talk about. I want to give some examples of typical questions I think probably a 10 or 12-year-old kid would ask once they knew this information we just talked about. Things like, because once you know how the body works, in this case, with respect to its bones and calcium metabolism, this should naturally generate some questions. Questions like, okay, first, how could bone come into existence if it needs to have two different types of cells? And where did the information come from that tells them what to do?
Hmm.
Or another one. How did controlled nerve, gland, and muscle function come about if the cells first needed to have both calcium pumps and calcium ion channels, and where did the information come from to produce them? And third, and which is the biggie, how did the control of calcium in the blood come about if you first needed to have a calcium sensor receptor, the information and ability to produce parathyroid hormone, and also PTH receptors, placing them exactly where they're needed, and the parathyroid gland cells knowing what the calcium level should be? Those are the type of questions that Darwinists need to be asked, because what they talk about, and I've said this in my articles, they show you how life looks. They don't talk about how life actually works. And
absolutely.
In the articles, I talk about how it works within the laws of nature.
Well, this is all absolutely fascinating, and I look forward to further conversations with you, Doc.
So do I, Ray. We barely scratched the surface.
Well, indeed, and we have more exciting explorations to come. Again, my guest today has been Dr. Howard Glicksman, and for ID to Future, this is Ray Bolin, and thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.